Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. Time to love it. Gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I'd like to welcome you this evening as we take our virtual trip to Jamaica, land we love. So, as I do each week, I ask you to relax and think of the times that you were on the island, whether you were visiting, you were living there, you were born and raised there, or whatever. If you've been, you know, as they say in their ads. So now we're going to close our eyes, get rid of all the stress of the week or the day or even the moment, and do the thing we do best in Jamaica. Just chill with no problem on. So I invite you to join me and select your favorite chair and your favorite drink, even if we're making believe now, because with this technology we can do things virtually. So just get there by any means you can. So you're now on the island and you're relaxed, and we're going to elaborate. So tonight I'm quite excited because I was sort of drawing a blank as to what I was going to do for this week. And I can't remember how I stumbled on the idea for this story, but it has been very meaningful for me, and I think you'll hear as I go into it. So as usual, I want to welcome everyone listening online and those who may come by later and those calling in. And I'm hoping that you, as usual, you know this is a Labrish. So if you have called in, I expect you to raise your hands by hitting 1 on your keyboard, which will indicate to me that you would like to join the Labrish. This is a very relaxed format that we have here on Backyard Labrish, because the whole objective is to sort of research the history that has not been verbalized. I can't say not been exposed, because everything is online now, even things from the past. So it's just a matter of perhaps you haven't gotten around to seeing it or know about it. So I am hoping that the service that I'm offering will be helpful in some way, and you are welcome to participate. So if you're on my list, you know tonight I'm going to talk about the arrival of the Windrush in Jamaica in 1948. And I was sort of a little surprised because there are quite a few people, who, even though they might have been in Jamaica and in Kingston at the time of the Windrush, they didn't particularly know about it. And I shouldn't really be surprised, because I remember in those days, the only very important things got in the newspapers. I'm sure that made the Daily Gleaner, but unless you had some involvement with the ship, I don't think it would be a big deal to you. I remember I was 13 years old. But I'll tell you later why it's so vivid in my mind. So what I thought I'd do is to sort of give everybody, if whether you know it or not, a little history about the Windrush. Now, remember now, this is 1948, so we were at the time. Now, what's happening now is that I researched, my research led me to the fact that this was a Nazi ship. It was a German ship originally. And I'll go into that first, because I'm saying that to say that I'm sure that most of the passengers of the ship perhaps didn't even know that then. Anyway, it was a diesel-powered motor ship, and it was built in Hamburg, Germany. And it was launched in December of 1930. And actually, it belonged to the Hamburg South American Steamship Company, and they named it, they got, you know, delivery of it in 1931, and they named it Monte Rosa, M-O-N-T-E-R-O-S-A, and it was used for cruises. Now, many passengers on these cruises were aboard as privileged Nazi Party members, as part of the Nazi Strength Through Joy program, intended to reward and encourage party members as a reward for services to the party. Now, I'm going to take a little break there, because in all of these stories, I try to connect how so many things have changed, and yet so many things remain the same. Now, remember, this was a very sad political period in the world because, you know, the Nazis were, I don't know if they had already started the invasion, but the ship was being used for the party to reward the special party members. And as we're in a political situation right now in our country, you know what I mean by that, because the rewarding of special privileged party members is still going on all over the world, I guess. So there it was. That was the purpose of the ship at the time. Now let me go on further about the ship itself. Now, during the Second World War, the ship was used as a barracks ship. This is by the Germans, of course. Then as a troop ship for the invasion of Norway. And those who know a little history will know how important that battle was in April of 1940. She was later used as an accommodation and recreational ship attached to another battleship. And it was stationed in the north of Norway. And it played a very important part in the, attacking the Allied convoys that was en route to Russia. Now, back to my sidebar. If those of us that's old enough to remember the war period, we remember that things were rationed in Jamaica. I remember that clearly. We had ration books. And what I know my parents told me that is because the ships could not come through with, you know, like condensed milk and the things we imported, the things we did not grow on the island or were manufactured. There wasn't much manufacturing going on then. So I remember we had these ration books. So you can see now that with the enemy attacking the ships en route to any place, you can see how things, I suppose, were really scarce. So back to this. I just find this very fascinating, the connections, you know, of the different dots. So I hope that the listeners will find it fascinating, too. Now, while based in Norway, the ship also was used to transport prisoners from Norway to concentration camps and prisons. At least 46 6 Jews were deported on the ship, of whom only 2 survived. So we know that the ship, prior to being captured by the British, was used for that purpose. And I just found it, you know, very interesting to mention that. Now, in 1945, the ship was in the Baltic, where it was used as a refugee evacuation ship by the Germans. It used to rescue Germans that were trapped in East Prussia. And that's where the British apparently got it. So in 1945, the Monte Rosa was captured by advancing British forces and taken as a prize of war. The following year, the ship was assigned to the British Ministry of Transport and converted into a troop ship. She was then named the HMT Empire Windrush on the 21st of January 1947 and used on the Southampton-Gibraltar Canal going to Hong Kong fleet. So you can see now where it now gets into British hands. Now, I'm saying that to say I am sure my brothers and sisters on the Windrush, when it came to Jamaica, did not even know that this was a Nazi ship. I think they would be a little even more scared. So let me, I'd like to remind the listeners aboard that you can put up your hand at any time and make a comment or ask a question or just interact. So let me know when you want to do so. So now the British have the ship. Okay? So I'd also like to take a minute I found this interesting too, to let you know that it's customary, I suppose. Remember, the England was then an empire. And there's a note here on Wikipedia, incidentally, that information came from Wikipedia because I always like to quote where I get my information. Now, the name derives from a series of ship names used by the British government for the ship they owned or chartered for the carriage of troops. Many of these ships were secondhand, like the Empire Windrush was, and renamed when bought. The names begin with Empire, of course, because they were an empire, and then they added the name of a river in Britain. So there is a river, a tributary of Thames is called the Windrush. The river is the Windrush, and that is how it became to be called the Empire Windrush. Now, most of the writings, of course, about the Windrush and its passengers after it came to Jamaica never really mentioned the empire. It just says the Windrush. And I said, that is so typical of us. Most of these writings, of course, a lot of them are by the Jamaicans who actually made the trip. For historical purposes, I mean, the writings are. But it just stands in line how we tend to shorten things and make them crisp and, you know, sharp. So I thought I'd throw that in. So here it comes now. In 1948, the Windrush was en route from Australia to England via the Atlantic, docking in Kingston, Jamaica. An advertisement had appeared in a Jamaican newspaper offering cheap transport on the ship for anyone who wanted to come and work in the United Kingdom. At that time, there were no immigration restrictions for citizens of one part of the British Empire moving to another part. The arrival of the boat immediately prompted complaints from some members of Parliament, but legislation controlling immigration was not passed until 1962. Among the passengers were Calypso musician Lord Kitchener, Lord Beginner, and Mona Baptiste, alongside 60 Polish women displaced during the Second World War, and one stowaway who was Avil Wankob. She was a 25-year-old seamstress who was discovered 7 days out of Kingston. But the passengers on board the ship organized on board and raised 50 pounds, enough for her fare with 4 pounds of pocket money for her. Now, isn't that interesting? I thought that was very interesting because she stowed away apparently because she didn't have the fare. So the people who paid to get on board, once she was discovered 4 days into the trip, they collected. So I wonder what they would have done with her anyhow. Perhaps locked her up. I'm sure they couldn't take her back. They were 4 days out at sea, and they certainly couldn't throw her on board, overboard. So, you know, folks, I'm just being comical as we go through all of this. So anyway, this very entrepreneurial young woman, now remember, guys, this is a diesel ship. So you can imagine these Jamaicans that left had never been on that type of vehicle before. A lot of them came from all over the islands. I'm sure many of them might not even have owned automobiles because we're talking about 1948. When, you know, there weren't a lot of cars even here in America, let alone in Jamaica. So I think it's very fascinating that a 24-year-old, 25-year-old young woman by herself would stow away on a ship like that. But anyway, this is from Wikipedia. I'm going to read you some of the articles that I found on the whole story. But I didn't see any place else where they mentioned about the collection of money that gave her enough to pay for her fare and had some left over. It said here now, so she even became more fortunate. Now, Nancy Conrad, C-U-N-A-R-D, who was traveling on the ship. She was heiress to the Conrad shipping fortune. She was on her way back from Trinidad, and she took a fancy to this stowaway young lady and intends to look after her. So I suppose she took her, she adopted her or took her to her house or something. And in 1998, an area of public open space in Brixton was renamed Windrush Square to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the arrivals of the West Indians. But that's sort of getting ahead of itself. But I wanted to tell you that, you know, what happened on the ship itself. So it docked in Kingston. There was an advertisement in the paper. Remember, everything was British at the time, that they had these. What happened is that they just had extra space on the ship. So they wanted to fill up the berths, I suppose. So they put an ad in. And 469 people bought tickets to go to England on the ship. They came from all over the different parishes, and a lot of them were returning servicemen. They had gone to they were part of the Second World War, and they apparently, some of them had come back to Jamaica. So they were returning Air Force people and Army people. So I'm going to take a break now and ask if there's anyone on the board that would like to interact. Please put your hand up. And so I can see you. I see no hands. So I'm going to go back to reading. I wonder if people don't get bored with me just reading, because Folks, believe me, I'm reading all of this for the first time. And I want to take a minute to let everybody know that I'm quite a senior citizen with all sorts of challenging, including my eyes are challenged. And sometimes when I try to print something out, you know, it's missing parts or it seems to be missing parts. So please bear with me here. Okay, so what I'm going to be reading now is from another article that I found on the internet, not from Wikipedia. The first part was from Wikipedia. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened when the ship arrived. And I just want to say that, you know, I just love the power of the internet because people have posted actual photographs that were taken on the ship themselves. I was trying to see if I knew anybody, but because here's where I want to tell you that my father left on the Windrush, and I remember my mother and I going to the pier and watch him walk on to the ship. And that was the very last time I saw him, because 2 years after that, he was killed in an accident in London, and we never, ever saw him again. So I don't know what led me to this, and I can't even remember how I came on all the story. But, of course, I never knew. I knew it was a Windrush, and I knew the year it left, but didn't know anything else about the ship itself or where it landed when it got there. You know, I was 13. I was just starting my teenage years. And my father and I were very close. I am an only child. And I remember him taking me to the movies to see the cowboy movies at Palace. That was the name of the theater. I don't know if anybody on the board remember Palace. It was an open-air theater. And they would show the serials, they were called, and they always have a cliffhanger, you know, you go this week and the carriage is going down the precipice, as we call it in Jamaica, and then they cut and you have to come back next week to see if the people are saved. I see a hand up at 914-665-300, so I'm going to open up the mic and welcome you. Hi, you got Margaret in the backyard. Who do I have?
Hi, Margaret. This is Carl from Mount Vernon.
Oh, welcome, Carl. How are you today?
Pretty good, thanks. I was very curious about the... I recollect that it was the Cunard ship, Magnet, that name of the lady who took the stowaway under her wings.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I don't know, is there any further information, follow-up in this story about that name involved with starting of a big shipping line that was involved in moving produce and or like bananas and coffee?
Well, but I would have to go to a link to find that. This particular one just mentioned that she was from the shipping family, whatever.
Oh, they did mention the shipping.
So you're familiar with her? Her name?
Yeah, well, I know the name, and the name Cunard was always associated with shipping. And
Yes. Well, it must be from that. So she's from that
That's
family.
The same family.
Remember here, it mentioned
also,
here.
Also, it was, if I may just shift gears a little bit, there was also a practice on ships when they found a stowaway, like when you go to the restaurant and you don't have the money to pay for the meal, they would let you wash dishes. I'm sorry, my phone is ringing. I didn't switch it off. So anyway, maybe I should stop and let you go on so as to get away from this noise.
Oh, okay. Well, come when you come back on. I can put it up again.
Okay.
Well, it stopped, so you can go ahead.
No, it hasn't stopped. It has one
okay.
more ring and then it stops. Okay. Okay,
all
go
right.
ahead. Yes.
So you were saying?
No, I was saying that what they usually do, just like when you go to a restaurant in the United States, I remember that if you didn't have enough money to pay the bill, you wound up in the kitchen to wash the dishes. And on these ships, they usually found work for the stowaways for the entire course of the journey. And if they have any information on them, like criminal records or something, then of course the police was waiting for them when they landed at the other end of the journey.
Right.
But she was fortunate in that the other people on board saved enough, I mean, collected enough money that she was a legitimate paying passenger.
Right.
That helped her, yeah.
Right, and it showed how, you know, I'm sure people would still do it now, but, you know, people have always come to the rescue and help out.
Right.
So I was quite touched with that.
Right.
Now, let me go back a little and tell you, it's so ironic because that ship only made that one kind of, you know, offer for people to get on board to go to England. It never happened again.
Oh.
Because 6 years after that, the ship was involved now in the war thing on whatever was going on.
Mm-hmm.
6 years after that, the ship made its final voyage because they had a fire on board while it was transporting some people. So I'm just saying, knowing my Jamaican brothers and sisters, first of all, perhaps if they knew that it was a Nazi ship and it transported people to the concentration camps and all of that, they would be quite scared, don't you think?
Certainly. They
I'm telling you. And this was a diesel type thing. You know, it took 30 days to get to London. So it's quite a long trip.
Yes.
And, you know, just being a woman myself, I just cannot even imagine a young 25-year-old woman being a stowaway on a ship like that with so many men.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She was fearless. And I would be interested to know what became of her.
How
do you pronounce this name again? It's
Cunard.
C-U-A-R-D.
Cunard.
Nancy's first name.
Cunard.
Cunard, yes.
Yeah, and
well, they say she was a heiress to the Cunard shipping fortune.
Right.
To be
I have another question when you're ready.
Yeah, okay.
No, and you mentioned Lord Kitchener, the well-known Calypsonian from Trinidad.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't aware that he was in the spotlight from as far back as 1948.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when they landed in Britain, while he was on the voyage, he wrote a calypso about England.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he apparently was a very artistic and good writer, which he performed a cappella right before he got disembarked. Because the announcers, you know, it was a big thing in London, and there are quite a few videos that have been found that they've put them in on YouTube now. So I was so fascinated. I was up till all hours, you know, listening to the songs. And he actually sang it. He was interviewed by the BBC, and he actually sang the song he wrote, "London is the place for me." London, that some whatever, but it was real interesting. So he wrote that, you know, while he was on the voyage.
And I
don't know. He apparently was in Jamaica to get on the ship.
Well, I imagine also that he must have returned to the West Indies because his notoriety was more on the stage and performing. Well, I know, at least I knew of the name in Jamaica and the other islands.
Right.
I think Lord Kitchener was Trinidadian.
Yes.
Of Trinidadian origin.
Right.
So I don't know what happened.
You know, a lot of times these articles don't give you the backup on the people that we know and things like that. But I'm sure if I search around, most of these things come from different websites.
Right.
I get some one information here and one information somewhere else. So, but I would invite the listeners to do their own research. You know, it's always very interesting because sometimes if you are on something, there's a link, they will mention that more information about that subject is somewhere else, so you can click on that too.
Right.
Okay, so we know now that the ship was destroyed. It had a fire on board. As a matter of fact, a couple of the people in the engine room got killed. No passengers were injured. They had to be rescued by another ship.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about as little as, you know, short, not a long time after it made this trip. So I thought that was rather interesting. So let me tell you now a little bit about the arrival itself and all the things that were going on. I'm sure I covered the point that some people in England at the time, you know, in the government were not comfortable with what was going on with all of these people coming in all at the same time. They were really not prepared for them. So it says here, now the Empire Windrush arrived at Tilbury, T-I-L-B-U-R-A, on the 22nd of June. Now remember they left in, when did they leave? I forgot. But anyway, I know it's 30 days, or 30 or 31 days. June 9th, 1948, carrying 493 passengers from Jamaica, wishing to start a new life in the United Kingdom. The passengers included, and it says, again, one stowaway and those other famous people that we talked about. Now, this article says, this is from History Today, I think is the name of the website. June 22nd, 1948, the day that the Windrush discharged its passengers at Tilbury, has become an important landmark in the history of modern Britain. And the image of the Caribbean's filing off its gangplank has come to symbolize many of the changes which have taken place here, meaning England. Caribbean migrants have become a vital part of British society and in the process transformed important aspects of British life. So that one voyage was really historic because it forever changed the landscape of Britain. And I am thinking, here we go again, Jamaica, starting. Isn't that wonderful? There are so many stories where, I mean, I know the other islands have a lot of important people that have done a lot of things. But I find it ironic that in almost all the stories I do or I have done, you know, it's a Jamaican who's being the first. It's a group of Jamaicans that are being the first to do something someplace in another part of the world other than Jamaica. So we've been really, really making some big strides for a long time. And you can just imagine, you know, coming from a small island like Jamaica and not have ever traveled for such a long time, because even then in Jamaica, if people were coming from the country, you would do it in a day. You know, right. It might be many, many more hours than they're doing it in now, but you would not necessarily even have to overnight. And these pioneers were actually excited about the opportunity of going to just blindly going, because a lot of them didn't know where they were going to stay, what was going to happen when they got there. There are a few of them who might have had people there before. But I just want to celebrate the idea that they were so adventurous.
Yes, I agree. Okay. Also, if I may interrupt, remember also that we related to or referred to England as the mother country.
Mother country, yes.
And we felt whatever things were, we were not able to gain employment, for example, that there was a lot more opportunities going to the mother country. Of course, there's a lot of things that developed once the immigrants landed. They had a rude awakening as time went by. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. So the article says here, in 1948, Britain was just beginning to recover from the ravages of the war. Housing was a huge problem and stayed that way for the next two decades. There were plenty of work, but the Caribbeans first clashed with the natives over the issue of accommodation. But alongside the conflicts and the discrimination, another process was taking place. Extended for much of the social and economic life around them, excluded from much of the social and economic life around them, they began to adjust the institutions they brought with them, the churches, and a cooperative method of saving called the partner system.
Yeah.
At the same time, Caribbeans began to participate in institutions to which they did have access, trade unions, local councils, and professional and staff associations. And I said, you know something, I watched a video while I was trying to research all of this that talked about the people getting suspicious, the English people getting suspicious about how Jamaicans were suddenly acquiring homes. And they were paying for them with cash.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all sorts of rumors wondering where they're getting the money from, because they didn't know about the partner. So that's for the visitors that may come along later that might not know what that is. It's called, I think, Susu on another island.
I think it's Trinidad.
And on another island, it might be called something else. But there's a video, and I'm going to have it on my website eventually, where this Jamaican is explaining to the BBC that they're not getting the money illegally, but it's a system of cooperative saving that each person would put in a certain amount each week. They'd have a banker, and one person would get that lump sum of money. And I'm sure that it had been going on the islands, and I remember it when I was growing up. However, to the foreigners, that was really, really different. Because, of course, in those days, the young people might not know this, but there were no credit cards and banks you could go borrow money to buy a house.
Yeah, and also, if I may interrupt that, I believe that it's a special class of immigrants who were attuned to the idea of owning, of home ownership.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, when you compare, like in the United States, a lot of the newcomers were so accustomed to getting into an apartment and spending, and they have very good jobs, and yet it never occurred to them that they could purchase the building or the home or the house where they were renting.
Right.
And it was very unusual at such an early stage that these new immigrants could become property owners.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it was a special class of people who were accustomed to that kind of independence.
Right,
and
right.
Entrepreneurial,
there were,
you know,
several articles about the fact that some of the Jamaicans that came were never, ever exposed to racism, because in their country they saw all different shades of people in different positions. There's a different article on that. So they were not intimidated.
No.
By you know, the people, and would be just as if they were at home. Well, of course, sometimes it didn't work.
That's
but
true.
one particular man said that he was really, it was a rude awakening for him, because he was never treated any different in his country he was coming from.
That's right.
So, you know, he couldn't sort of wrap his head around it and had to deal with it. So the article goes on to talk about an identity here, which I want to share. And then I'm going to read one man's story. I think his name is, and I hope that it's all right for me to read it, because anything that is published online that is not private is really public information.
Of course.
I think his name is, I forgot his name. I don't even know if he's still alive. But he was a passenger, Arthur Curling. And I'm hoping that even after this show is in archives, if anyone come by and hear any of these names, I always like to call the names, because they might know some relatives or know something about the person before they left Jamaica, or their family, or, you know, even their family now in England. So I always love to connect the dots. So I invite you to visit backyardlabrish.com. You can send me a comment, an idea. You know, if you know something you'd like me to discuss, please just let us know. We have a website that you can access and do all of that. So let me get back to thehistorytoday.com. This particular thing I'm going to share with you now came from. It says one of the passengers on the ship became the mayor of Southwark. His name was Sam King, and he served in England with the wartime RAF. His family had sold 3 cows to buy his ticket, which cost £28, 10 shillings in the old money. So it was upwards of £600 today. This is someone writing in England about, this is a paper from someone in England. Looking back on the experience years after, in 40 Winters On, published by Lambeth Council, he recalled that as the ship drew towards England, there was apprehension on board that the authorities would turn it back. He got 2 ex-RAF wireless operators among the passengers to play dominoes innocently outside the ship's radio room and eardropping on incoming signals. They heard on the BBC that Arthur Creek Jones, colonial secretary in the Labour government for the time, had pointed out that, in quotations now, these people have British passports and they must be allowed to land. He added that they would not last one winter in England anyway, so there was nothing to worry about. Ain't that something?
That sure is.
So this Mr. Sam King had, he knew his buddies could read the Morse code. You remember Morse code?
Oh, yes.
So they arranged a domino game. We are so smart. Right outside the radio room. So they weren't really playing dominoes. They were pretending to play dominoes while they listened to the tap, tap, tap. You know what I mean?
Very crafty.
That was quite intriguing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they said, went on to say, one of them was the future mayor of South, well, I think I told you that.
Yes.
Sam King, who has served in England with the wartime RAF. I read that already.
Yes.
Okay, the newspaper was already keenly interested in the voyage of what they embarrassingly called the Sons of Empire. And the Colonial Office the Home Office and the Ministry of Labor were busily engaged in trying to dodge responsibility for the newcomers, whose imminent arrival they viewed with alarm. You know, there's a whole lot of them coming, 492.
Wow.
Eventually, the Colonial Office, defeated in these bureaucracies' maneuverings, reluctantly opened the deep arid shelter on the Chaplain Common, and about 230 of the new arrivals moved into it. The others had organized some sort of job and accommodations for themselves beforehand. The labor exchange nearest Clapham Common happened to be the one in Brixton. And it was this that made Brixton the first of London's new West Indian ghettos.
Mm.
So that is how the most of the immigrants were put up in this air raid shelter, because no housing was really, I suppose, planned for them. Because I think it was sort of haphazard. You know, they had the extra birches on the ship. It was going to Jamaica. Whoever was in charge of the shipping line, and I think I read it was the Ministry some department in Britain, and they never figured out that 492 people were going to buy tickets to come. They perhaps just figure a few, because some of them could not. There were pictures. I think they said the servicemen had to be housed in the hall or someplace. But I don't think they expected the reception, you know, how well people would come up with the money to go.
Right.
So they were not really prepared. So they were quite embarrassed. But, you know, it really changed the landscape and the culture of Britain forever. Now, here is Arthur Curlin's story. I came to England first in 1944 in the Air Force. I returned to Jamaica in 1946 after spending 2 years there. It was too small for me. I joined the Air Force when I was 16. At the same time, I left school, took my test, and waited for the results. It was something beautiful at the time to all the young fellas in uniform. You think you want to be a part of something, but apart from that, you can't always say why you do something. You're young. And you don't stop and think of the dangers and things. You just do what you feel you want to do, regardless of what your parents say.
Right.
My parents did not approve in the beginning, but they had no choice at the time. But like everything else, it's your life or your education. You gain an experience. I went back to Jamaica in November of 1946. The Windrush arrived in 1948. I returned to England. You know your parents are strict for one. Now you have more freedom. After you reach a certain time in life, you think you want to get away from the control of your parents. So here he is. Quite a grown man, but he's writing of his experience of when he came on the Windrush. This is a sidebar, folks. I'm back to the letter, to the article now. As a matter of fact, I had a responsibly good job in Jamaica, and things were looking up. It's just a matter of the island is too small. You don't realize how small until you have traveled.
So
he had been to England before, you know, in the RAF, he went back to Jamaica and it just shrunk for some reason. One doesn't feel that you know everything. What happens, what you feel is a sense of freedom. I went to Bermuda, met a lot of Bermudians. I was in a crowd of people again. Many were ex-servicemen. You were able to do things. I had a relation on the ship, a relative on the ship who was going to see his brother. No, a relation on the ship who was going to see his brother, who was studying at the time. It's difficult for me to go back because I've never looked back. I always try to look forward in life. I wouldn't say England has been good to me, but I say it made a change in my life at the time. England was the easiest country to get into and the hardest country to get out of. The mere fact is, if you're working, you never earn enough money for your fare. But at the same time, you always say you always have another 10 years, 15, 20 years. You get yourself involved in things. I have spent most of my life in England. I have traveled quite a lot on the continent of Africa. And I went to Liberia, Sierra Leone, South Africa, and North America.
Wow.
But England has something that you want to get back to. You can't put your finger on it. I can see he's quite passionate about the mother country. There is a racism, but it's up to the individual how you concentrate on it, counteract it. The fact is, if a man say you are black, so and so, you can't say you are white, so and so. If you even get to F-I-S-T-I cuffs, what's that? Fisticuffs. Oh, the best man win. Oh, that if you get in a fight.
Yeah.
It's true, racism is more prominent with the younger generation. This generation doesn't put up with it. The way we as old colonials come here and accept it. Violence is part of the society today, and people will say that the black man does that, but they never gave the reason he does it. When black people wanted to do things in politics, there are always some excuse. But as the younger generation in the system today, they aren't asking for more. And the younger generation had very few role models to follow. If you look at countries like Canada, where West Indians are being Jamaican, I would prefer to be a Jamaican myself. Went long after they start coming to England. They are much more advanced. They have a series of being a West Indian. They don't mind your keeping your culture, and they accept it. People started going there as professionals during the Michael Mandy era. Most of the cream left the island, and that's what broke the political system of the island. The doctors, the lawyers, everybody wanted to go to Canada or America. Unlike England, it was ordinary working class, the factory workers, etc., who came to England. So that is Arthur Curlin's story. And, folks, there are all sorts of stories about it's being called, really, the Windrush culture or the Windrush era, because it made such an impact. And there were all different classes of people, colors of people, actually. There's a picture of a very light-skinned man and his two children getting off the ship. There were quite Jamaicans that were white, but of course the biggest collection was of true African descent, you know, by the pictures. But I just thought it's quite fascinating that there were so many other little incidents that connected the whole thing together, you know, like the stowaway, like the story of the ship. But, you know, I must say that most of the articles, I don't really have time to really go through all of them. We're only on for an hour tonight. But there are so many interesting stories of people and some of the younger generations there is a business called the Black Farmer, and I think he's this man. I did his story. It's in the archives. He's a descendant from one of the people on the Windrush, and he's a very successful farmer in the part of England where there are only white farmers, and he's doing very, very well. As a matter of fact, I signed up for his newsletter and get all the interesting stories all the time, and the name of his business is the Black Farmer. So if you'd like to, if you're listening from London, England, I'm sure you perhaps know about him, but if you'd like to research him, just Google that and you'll get the information. But I'd also like, again, to ask if anyone know of anyone who left on Windrush, or if they're a Kingstonian and they remember any buzz around the time, if they were old enough. I happen to be 13, and I don't think I would have known about it except that my father was one of those with the suitcase going on it. So please let me know by putting up your hand, hitting one on your telephone, and I'll open the mic for you. So, Carl,
yes.
I was really carried away by all the stories. And as I said, there are several videos about the actual trip, you know, people talking about the trip. And they interviewed, the BBC interviewed the people, because it was such a big thing politically, you know, because here are all these people coming. Some people are saying they shouldn't be coming. Some people are saying, they got British passports. They're entitled to come. But that, the Jamaicans that came then opened up the way for Sierra Leone, for India, for people from all over, all these other much bigger places than Jamaica itself.
Raised the pathway. You know, it's fascinating to, when you look at the history of some of these new immigrants, how some of them stayed in Great Britain and even went down up to Scotland and so on, and were very successful. Of course, there was always a group that was yearning to return back to Jamaica, and some of them did. And I remember the stories of the young men who joined the Royal Air Force, and they got involved, at least they married white women and returned with them to Jamaica. Some went back with great ideas for business that they never thought of before. And, of course, there are some who had very sad stories, because some families were broken up where either the wife or the husband was more adventurous, and they left children at home in Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
and they went traveling on this trip to this unknown place.
Right.
It's fascinating.
But you know, historically, the trip itself was a landmark.
Oh, yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
There are so many individual stories out of the group,
right.
But the influx of those people arriving on that day all at once changed the landscape of Britain forever. And that's really the strong point that I want to bring out here,
right.
Because it's amazing. It's to me, it's amazing, you know, how I just feel that when things are to happen, everything line up.
Yes.
Because it didn't say, you know, how much ahead of the time of the ship sailing the ads came out, and I wish Dr. Lumsden would research that. She's such a great research person.
Yeah.
You know, when the ad came out in the newspaper, and when the ship actually sailed, because it's the newspaper why people knew,
right.
Because you know warships used to come in there, the port of Kingston. Kingston was a big port. I remember when I was growing up, there was a lot of shipping activities going there, and we had the Myrtle Bank Hotel right down King Street there.
Right.
So it was a big shipping port during those days.
And
so,
of course, they were shipping the bananas,
right.
And
it's
sugar.
Mostly like cargo and tourists. Well, afterwards, there was tourists.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is that was there was no talk on the in the documentation as to if a lot of these people knew each other. I think the servicemen may have known each other. You know what I mean?
Really?
But you have almost 500 people who have come together on one ship.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a luxury liner. I think it was a little, perhaps, upscale for its time. Because remember, the Nazis used to use it as a incentive for their party performers.
Right.
So it was not perhaps like the rest of the ships. It might have been jazzed up a little. But even then, travel was a hassle, especially for women.
Yes.
For 30 days, you know. So I am very inspired when I read these stories, and I'm always a little bubbly when I'm telling them, and it's really true passion for these people who are real pioneers that would just even have the thought. Some of them were... Well, some of these guys, when they joined the service, were 16 and 17. And a lot of the guys did not come back to Jamaica. My mother had 5 sisters and 1 brother. Her youngest brother was 17 when he joined the Air Force and left Jamaica and never, ever came back.
Yes, yes.
He got married there after he got out of the Air Force and, you know, had a family. And none of his other siblings, except one aunt who went to England, all my aunts have passed away, but she actually met his children. But, you know, we never, ever saw him again. I remember my mother taking me to the railroad station. I was quite little at the time. This is before 48. And she got off the train. He was dressed in his uniform. He hugged her, hugged me. And I never, ever saw him again.
Mm.
So I don't remember. They must have had another ship that took those RAF fellows at the time. But I just thought the story was quite fascinating. And there are lots of other aspects of the story. There's a page where quite a few of them wrote their personal story about the voyage itself. But pretty soon I'll be launching a new Backyard Labrish website, and I plan to put some of the videos, especially the one with Lord Kitchener singing the song he composed while he was at sea.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Yes, yes, yes. I was trying to perhaps get it to play for you this evening, but when I found it, I didn't have time to do the technical part of it. So with that said, I don't see any other show of hands. So I see quite a few people on the board. 914-441-352-671, 404, and some other ones. So I guess nobody wants to talk to me right now. But I do hope you've enjoyed the little story. I don't know if you were familiar with the story of the Windrush and its Jamaican passengers who made history by being the first and largest group of Caribbeans, of foreigners, really, from any of the colonies that landed in England and changed the landscape forever. They never had that amount of people from India, from Africa, from nowhere else. Jamaica. First
it was definitely
again.
A milestone in the movement of people from such a great distance across the Atlantic, which they now describe the pond. And
right.
There were no airline services that were moving people. It was all ships.
Uh-huh.
And there are a number of shipping lines that followed that route.
Right, right. And that, you know, the route was being watched and ships torpedoed during the war by the Nazis.
Yes.
So I realized, no, that's why we had to have ration books. We couldn't get our stuff. And they wanted to make sure that everybody got their fair share.
Right.
And I remember, boy, I'm telling you, so much has changed and so much remained the same. I remember there were families who, you know, I think they would estimated that or give you how much things you need depending on how many children you had in your family or whatever. So whether you were rich or poor, you couldn't get any more. But I remember some people used to sell their ration books because I remember my family buying extra. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just like we know people, we hear of people doing that here with stuff that they get or
yeah, but if you have the right connections, you can get what you want.
Yeah, so many things have changed, but so many things remain the same. And my take on that, you know, is because we are humans, and humans tend to have similar behaviors. It doesn't matter whether it happened, you know, before Christ, you know, during the Romans or during slavery. There were people who were compassionate. There were people who were mindful of other people and kind to them. And there were people who were hideous, you know, and mindless. It happens during every period. And, you know, the prejudice and the separation and the discrimination, you know, Jews
and the worship of the Almighty
dollar. Huh?
And the worship of the Almighty dollar.
Right.
Money.
So we have to remember in all of this that, you know, we are the ones that have to make the change. The change begins with you. And so before I close tonight, I want to challenge the listeners on the board, those listening online, and those who may come by later, that what do I want to see changed in the world, or whatever I want to see change, the change must begin with me. And we're never too old to make a change. So I hope and pray that you will give that quite some consideration. And we all have something we need to change. We all do. Sometimes we put it off. Sometimes we think it's not important. But we can be the change we want to see. So with that said, I want to again encourage you to embrace the new technology that we have by going to my website, backyardlabrish.com, www in front of it. I don't think you need that anymore. Things have gotten so, you know, high-tech that I don't think you need to put in the www, but I still say it. And leave me a note, send me a message, and let me know you're there, and do come back. Now, I must tell you that I think I announced last week that Backyard Labrish has met their goal of 50,000 downloads before our 50th anniversary. So I promised myself that once I did that, I was not going to be doing a live show every week. So the next live show, I'll give you the date. I have to take a break and get some other things done. The next live show will be September 20th. There will be a show that will be played each week, but I have a lot of shows in the archives that some of the new fans have not heard. I've covered many, many things, most of Dr. Lumsden's material, a lot of Dr. Tortella's material, and material from the Encyclopedia of Jamaican Culture. So there's a lot of wonderful historic facts that I have verbalized. So I'll be sending, if you're not on my list, please just send me a note to let me know you'd like to be on the list. I will be making a little blog about one of the interesting shows I think you like and sending you the link. If you can just click on the show while you're doing your email or so, and you will hear a recorded show. And then I'll be live again, hopefully, with a guest on the 20th. But I'll send you a promo about the content. So with that said, I love and appreciate you. Please continue your support. And remember to support the children in your life or in your family or in your community, because they are the next generation that is going to make us immortal. Because whatever we instill in them, whatever positive and things that we know are good, we believe to be good and meaningful, that we pass on to somebody else, is passing a piece of ourselves, leaving a living legacy. So with that said, Carl, do you have any parting words?
No, it was a joy to participate. I thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to some of the big plans you're making for, excuse me, for future broadcasts. And I know that you have provided a great service, especially looking back to the trailblazers of the past.
Who laid
the foundation for our young generation.
Great, great. Well, thank you so much.
My
it's always name. A pleasure to have you. And it's good to have some live company in the backyard. I see I have company, but, you know, they're so relaxed. They don't necessarily want to put their hands up. But that's fine. I still love them, and we love to have them here in the backyard. So as I close each week, ladies and gentlemen, we're here. We'll be here on the 20th, Thursday the 20th of September, where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica.
Love.
Where are you, Mr. Carl? You're supposed to join me in that chorus.
See.
And with that, I say, ladies and gentlemen, you have the power, so make it a great week. Good night.
Good night. Good night.